Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am stoked to have Amanda Kowalski on the podcast. She is the first vice president of behavior programs for the amazing San Diego Humane Society. And we chat about why we need to address the mental needs of the animals in our care, what behavior programs she's helped to implement at her shelter, how to overcome some challenges, and what are some first steps to help address the emotional well-being of the animals in our shelter? So lots of important stuff and wonderful wisdom from Amanda. I hope you guys enjoy. Hi, Amanda. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tabitha. It's really, really good to be here. I'm really excited.
This is a topic that me and Amanda really like, so we may get on some fun soapboxes. Yay! But to get started, because especially as behavior professionals, it's important for us not to just tell people this should happen. The whys and understanding why we are asking or why things are important are really, really crucial in everything. So I wanted to start with asking this super simple, right? Super simple question. Why do you feel like shelters need to address the mental needs of animals in their care? And what would you characterize or define as mental needs? Because I think that's another thing. We say enrichment and mental needs, but I don't think everyone has the same definition or really understands that it's a lot more than walking a dog, for example.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, we definitely can go down some rabbit holes with this topic.
Enrichment is more than play groups. Anyways. All right.
It's more than a lot of things, more than just, you know, taking a dog out to a yard and throwing a tennis ball. So why do we need to address the mental needs of animals in our care? Because they're going to experience a lot of fear, anxiety, and stress when they come into the shelter. And I think that's a really important perspective to have about the animal's experience when they do come into the shelter, is that those first few days especially are going to be critical for their ability to, you know, cope in a completely new environment. If you have an owner surrendered dog, they're losing a stable attachment figure. It is really jarring for them. You know, same thing for dogs that are coming, you know, maybe from your community as strays. They've had free access and free choice to a lot of things in their environment before coming into the shelter. And now we're putting them into an environment that not only has physical restraints, right? And it's restrictive in that way, but also it's restrictive socially as well for animals. And then on the flip side too, you have some animals who don't necessarily, aren't really into social interactions with other, you know, other people. And so it's incredibly terrifying for them to have to be around in close proximity to people, always having, you know, interactions with them throughout the day when they might need some space.
And I think we all know in shelter and vet med that addressing the mental needs are important, but this is a newer concept, not only with animals, let's be honest, with humans in our society, we're understanding that mental health and physical health are essentially equally important. So this may be, again, kind of like you mentioned, meeting the animal where they're at, identifying their fear, anxiety, and stress, and doing what we can. Although I understand shelters are very stressful, we do have quite a lot of control of the environment and the interactions, whether it's with other animals or people. So the good news is we can control a lot of things to make these experiences more positive or at least less stressful for each individual animal. And then, of course, every animal has individual outlets that they need to do. And that's going to look different in every animal. And that's kind of where enrichment and other tools that you can even share with the public or caregivers to help pet retention. Hey, friend, I'm here to help you. I hear your concerns. We love animals, but we would love to help you keep your animal in your loving home because we know you love them, but you just feel like there's no other option.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so going back to, you know, saying that we do have control over things in the environment. Yeah, there are some things that we do have control over that we can make it a better experience for that, you know, that animal. And there are ways that as, you know, shelter staff and volunteers that we can have systems in place to identify animals who are already at a higher risk of needing some intervention as soon as they come through your door, you know, and anyone who works in admissions, they have the hardest job because they are trying to get so much information from either owners who are coming, you know, to relinquish their pets, or from finders who are bringing, you know, the animal into their into the shelter's care. And that is an opportunity to capture some of that information about what that animal, what that individual animal is like, right? And observe how that animal is behaving while during that in admissions or intake, you know, process. And from there, you know, being able to highlight, well, if you're seeing mild, moderate, high levels of fear, anxiety, stress, you know, already starting to think about, you know, I need to flag this animal either for our behavior team or for the care staff, or volunteers, whoever is going to be the next touch point for that animal, to let them know so that they can keep that in mind and maybe modify their interactions with them. Make sure that you're using, well, you should always make sure that you're using low stress, you know, fear-free handling, and make sure that it's low stress, and, you know, but really, you know, be mindful of it going into that interaction, prepare for before that interaction, making sure you have all your high value, you know, food to help make it a more comfortable, you know, experience, maybe making sure that, you know, a, like if they need an exam, right, that there's an available office or room that is quiet, that's distraction free, that you can provide that, that exam or even intake treatments to that animal. So there's a lot of things that can happen as soon as that animal's coming into care to be able to, you know, identify, all right, we're going to have to immediately start providing some enrichment for that animal, enrichment or just intervention in general to help that animal while they're here with us.
No, I love that. I always say, because that's someone that obviously thinks behavior and physical health are equally as important. I triage medicine as a veterinary technician and medical situations, but I also, because I understand in shelters and even in vet med, we feel kind of like there's no way we have time or the skill sets, which is a whole nother thing, to do these things. So I'm like, I understand that implementing these policies and addressing the emotional well-being of animals, it takes time implementing behavior programs and things that we're going to talk to you more about. But a cool thing to start with is triaging behavior. Yeah. Which is essentially what you just talked about. We triage medical issues. I'll say like a cat that's faint sleeping due to severe stress. To me, I compare that to a cat that's bleeding out from a medical standpoint. So that really helps people understand the severity of the situation and how, like you mentioned, we understand that we have limited resources, but let's triage and at least help those animals assess the body language, do what we can to not only set that animal up for success, but also we don't want to throw staff members or volunteers into a situation where they may be injured due to that animal being fearful or not comfortable with that level of fear in animals. So I think that's a really good point to bring up. And that's a lovely segue to bring up, because San Diego Humane is amazing. And a big part of that is due to all the amazing people that work there, but also you. We got to give you props, Amanda. You're pretty amazing. I know it's weird to tell people how great they are in front of them. You guys, be nice, reinforce each other. Let's do that more often. Anyways, but San Diego Humane offers quite a few behavior resources and programs, not only to the animals in their care, but also to the adopters and the general public to help keep those animals in their lifelong living home so they don't come back or come to you to begin with. But also you empower your staff and the general public to be educated to feel more comfortable in situations, whether an animal's fearful or they're dealing with a behavior concern. Could you tell us, I know there's so many, could you tell us a little bit more about the behavior programs San Diego Humane offers?
Yeah, absolutely. So I oversee everything behavioral at San Diego Humane. And I'm going to take a step back because I just want to I guess, put into context how big San Diego Humane is.
That is important. Context, guys. Yes.
We are one of the largest open admission shelters in the country. We have 5 different campuses, and we provide animal services to 14 different cities in San Diego County. Now, San Diego County is huge. We provide services to about 3.3 million people in the community. So we're reaching out, and we are trying to, you know, provide all those things to a lot of people, a lot of animals that are in our community and even beyond. Every year we are working with about 40,000 animals in our community that come into the shelter, and those could be companion animals. We have a facility that houses livestock, and we also have a Project Wildlife, which is a wildlife rehabilitation program, which is really, really cool. About 13,000 wildlife from San Diego come into care, and we have an amazing medical team that cares for them and helps to rehabilitate them and then put them back into the community.
Oh, that's so great. I did not even know about that program. See,
oh my gosh. We have
so cool.
It is just like San Diego. San Diego is a really cool place. Like, you know, you can drive maybe 30, 40 minutes and be in a different terrain and kind of environment. And I feel that way about our campuses too, is that every single one of our campuses offers something unique, where, you know, our Escondido campus, we have horses and pigs, and our behavior team works with, you know, with these animals too, which is so cool. So we're not just working with dogs and cats, but other species as well. So context, this is San Diego Humane. We have almost 600 employees too. So as we talk about, you know, building behavior programs and implementing new initiatives and programs, you know, just thinking about how to get 600 people on board.
Yeah, more people can be obviously a really wonderful thing, but let's be honest, the more people involved does make it more challenging to implement changes.
Just a little.
For sure. And getting everyone on the similar page to set up everyone for success, for sure.
Yeah, just a little. So going back to the behavior program, we have behavior staff that span multiple locations. So Oceanside, Escondido, El Cajon, and the San Diego campus. And at the San Diego campus, we actually have a dedicated behavior center facility. So for behavior cases that are going to be long term, so more than, you know, 2 to 4 weeks in care, they would be transferred to our behavior center facility to receive additional behavior intervention. And we're working with cases, primarily dogs and cats who are showing high levels of fear. They've come into the shelter with that history, and that level of fear is preventing them from being successfully adopted into a new home. And so I want to preface that, you know, we're not fixing all the problems. And I think that's really important, is that I'm seeing, you know, a lot of, you know, shelters wanting to start behavior modification programs to completely like fix and resolve program or, you know, behavior conditions. And that is not what we're doing with, you know, with these animals. We are providing them with essential, you know, foundations for building coping skills, being more resilient in interactions with other people and with other animals, hopefully lowering some of that stress. And we do that in a few different ways. We utilize a lot of behavior fosters too throughout the organization. So our internal behavior team, they work with about 1,000 animals a year, mostly dogs and cats being number two. And then you have like a tiny small percentage of, you know, those other species that we work with, rats, rabbits, pigs, goats, horses. And then there's a whole other sector of our team, which is working with our community, which is really important for that proactive approach to trying to reach people in the community, give them free or low cost resources, and try to prevent those animals from coming into our shelter altogether, because we don't want them here. We want them in their homes with their owners, with their loving owners, and not have to come into a shelter and be stressed out. And so we offer to the public 40 different types of animal training classes. We work with an amazing group of positive reinforcement trainers in San Diego County that offer some of these classes. And then we have a small but mighty team of internal trainers that is their focus. So they don't work with any of the animals that are in care. They are dedicated to answering the almost 2,000 phone calls and emails that we get from our behavior helpline every year, helping them register for classes. We offer dog and cat classes. We have kitten kindergarten. We do adult cat classes, a shy cat class, and then all of your kind of basic foundational dog classes, and then going up to specialty classes as well. So dogs who, you know, are, you know, fearful, reactive rover type classes, separation related behaviors, things like that.
Love it. It's all amazing. And I love that you mentioned the fix the dog or the cat or the pig thing, because sometimes I think, especially if you aren't a behavior professional, understandably, you may have different perceived notions about how to handle these, or maybe you're just someone that you don't work in a shelter and you're just someone that loves animals and you're like, you should be able to fix this animal. And that is not how behavior works with just like, guys, I have, you know, I'm bipolar and I'm not ashamed of it. And it's very well managed and it's awesome. But if someone was just like, I'm going to fix your bipolar, I'd be like, dude, I'm a little offended. Let's take some steps back here. Let's break this down, because I'm not ashamed of it. It's not something I'm going to get rid of. That's not how anxiety disorders work. You can't cure aggression or kind of some of these other common myths. So
yeah,
I love that you mentioned that, because I do think that that's a really, we can have a whole episode on that, but as people who work in shelters, because we are caregivers, we want to fix everything. We are helpers. When it comes to behavior, behavior is complex. Every animal is an individual. And again, mental health and physical health are similar. So behavioral euthanasia is something that I am very experienced with, as I'm sure Amanda is, because if that animal is suffering mentally and we either do not have the resources available or the resources available aren't helping that animal live a good quality of life. Again, that's a whole nother episode. But I think that those things are really important, especially in the shelter world, because I recently spoke at a conference, and this makes me so sad, but a wonderful behavior professional that works at a shelter reached out to me and we were chatting after, and she was shamed and attacked and just really horrible things for making a very, very appropriate humane decisions, not only for that dog, but for the community. So again, that's very complex, but I just wanted to touch on, you don't fix behavior, you manage and work with that individual animal, and it's complex. So I just had to elaborate on that, because I do think that that's something really important to address, especially in shelters, because caregivers attack us too. And that's not, and that makes us, it's just, it's a rough situation altogether, but
we have hard jobs, Tabitha.
Yes.
We have really hard jobs, and you're right. Like, that is such an important aspect though of everything that we do. And it's one of the most challenging parts of all of our jobs, is having to make those difficult decisions, you know? But part of our job as a behavior professional in a shelter environment is recognizing when, you know, that animal is either going to be a safety risk to themselves or to others, or the quality of life aspect as well, you know? And one of the things that I like to share, you know, when I'm speaking with other shelters, or, you know, it's just something that we need to think about in our behavior modification program, you know, that the treatment cannot make the, you know, essentially that mental health issue, that whatever the animal is going through, the fear, anxiety, worse, it cannot make that any worse, you know, and it cannot impact that quality of life anymore for that animal. And it's something that we're always making sure that we're not, you know, for the sake of, you know, trying to, you know, help that animal, that we're causing more distress for that animal as well, you know. And then there's the whole, and like you said, I mean, we can have a whole episode about this, you know, and pathway planning and, you know, and all those things. And behavior euthanasia. And but it is, it's important to think about too, is, you know, that animal's quality of life outside of the shelter and what that what a potential adopter's quality of life is.
100%.
As well, behavior support can be incredibly expensive and it requires you to change aspects of your life for that animal, which could sometimes be incredibly isolating for those caregivers, you know? So it's really hard, but really important aspect of sheltering.
Yeah. And I think that's why also for our sakes that are making these decisions and being put into these, again, we lots of amazing like situations that we are put in. That's why we work in animal welfare, because we see these beautiful changes. We see what client education or community education does. It just makes us thrive. But obviously we're all also put into challenging circumstances. And that's where I think behavior programs, obviously they're important for a lot of the reasons we already talked about, but also having credentialed, educated behavior professionals. So we've all been in situations where we're winging it and we don't have the appropriate education to make these difficult decisions, which makes it so much more challenging. Or there's no SOPs about, there's no programs, there's no SOPs. And these choices are already very challenging. So when you have behavior programs and behavior services and SOPs, it makes those really challenging things a lot easier. And you have support not only from your colleague that's your, you know, work wife or work partner, but you also have support of the shelter's management, and all of that really matters. But again, we love humans too. And these behavior programs and SOPs that San Diego Humane's doing helps them make those difficult choices easier, and they don't feel alone in some of these really difficult choices.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's important to have those things written down. It, you know, it provides you with some guidelines for, you know, how to, you know, make those decisions.
That pathway planning type stuff that you were mentioning. Yeah.
Yeah. The pathway planning, you know, and what available resources do we have? It helps us kind of evaluate that and look at that animal as well. And, you know, look at, can we really realistically do this for this animal? You know, we're really good at helping fearful dogs, you know,
right.
But you know, there are other cases that are really complicated that, you know, aren't necessarily going to be cases that that we can help in the shelter, you know, and so we want to make sure that we're assessing, again, is this dog safe to place in a home, into a foster, you know, and provide some behavior intervention. And if not, then we have our guidelines for when we would have to make that euthanasia call. Those things written down and created with all of the folks who are going to be part of that decision making,
right.
I think is incredibly important, because again, it's helping you stay on the same page and it's giving you some guidance and a framework to work within, you know, to making those really difficult decisions.
Definitely. And like you mentioned already, those enrichment and behavior programs and assessing also helps to meet those basic needs of those animals, because food and water and shelter are important. But as we all know now, that meeting their mental needs and allowing them, like cats need to scratch and dogs need to sniff and all of these, cats do too, but you guys know what I mean. come on. Allowing them to have those opportunities and giving them choice in some things that they do throughout the day also helps them handle the stress of a shelter or the transition of a shelter or even going into a new home a lot easier. So it's like a beautiful circle where it just helps with many issues. And on that note, so you have a lot of amazing behavior programs. You guys have been working for, because a lot of people are like, San Diego Humane is huge and they have more resources and we can't do that. Guys, that's not the case. it took them a very long time. They started small and these things gradually grow into what they are today. And they're still, I already know about some really cool things that they are working on in the future, because they're always growing and learning more and improving. But on that note, whether it's a shelter that has more funding or a smaller shelter, which again, there's benefits to that as well. What are a few steps to help, just not to get started just yet, but just to help get, because this is a very real thing, staff and management on board to understanding the need to addressing behavior needs. Because they might just say, we'll just throw this med at the dog, or we're going to give it 2 weeks. Again, they're not doing any, they're not changing the antecedents or the environment or BMOD, and they're just giving it a time frame, which is, again, these are things I see happen. And there's a lot of great caregivers that are working there, and they're like, management doesn't really understand and they're not supporting us. So just to help get everyone, again, on the same page and on board, what are a few suggestions that you could share with my beautiful listeners out there?
First of all, this can be incredibly challenging. And, I'm really fortunate, and this is not lost on me, at how incredible, San Diego is to being supportive of behavioral wellness for animals. Like that's part of our standards of care, is making sure that we're meeting the needs of our animals behaviorally.
You've built that into your culture, and you've worked hard to do that.
It is. Yeah. And, that does provide somewhat of an advantage, is because we're already coming in with like that standard. But I've also had experiences in other, environments as either a staff member or volunteer where that's not necessarily, the case. I think, for me, what I always recommend is let's find that kind of agent of change, somebody within management that shares that, who can also be an advocate with other managers. And I think that that is something that can help start to like bridge that, that gap, and start to get other management involved and interested in, okay, what are some simple things that we can do? And that's kind of the next part too, is one, find that person that is in a management position that can help to, influence other management and start to bring them to the table. And then it's involving everybody who this might impact as soon as possible, to start talking about, what are our standards for caring for animals in the shelter, and kind of starting there, because I've experienced that behavior naturally starts to come up in those conversations. While maybe they're not saying it, it's starting to come up though, in examples that might be shared. And then that's an opportunity to be like, okay, so then how can we, how can we make that better for the animal? Bringing everybody to the table, identifying what some of those priorities are, and then starting to come up with, what are some like easy wins, to implement, and again, this is, it sounds formulaic, but this is kind of this is just a direction to start. And in my experience, it started to help with building momentum and moving in the right direction. And I think that's the one thing that I always have to remind myself, and I always, remind others too, whether or not it's my staff or some of the volunteers, is that we are going to be getting there. We're just going to be chipping away at, some of these smaller steps in order to get there and move in the right direction.
No, I love that approach. And in my experience working in shelter and vet med, it has been very similar. I learned through trial and error that getting really stoked and being super passionate, I'm sure you guys know I'm a bit passionate about these topics, and just throwing, again, I'm coming from a good place, but throwing a bunch of stuff at somebody shuts them down pretty quickly. Yeah. And then it's harder to build that rapport back up later, even if I have given, or what's the word I'm thinking of? Like buy-in. That's it, guys. Buy-in from other people. So I love the idea of getting someone that you have an idea that maybe they've in management where they've expressed concern, where they may have not identified it as a behavior concern, but realistically that's what it is. And then having them, I always say, find a cheerleader. And in many cases, I'm sure me and Amanda have been those people where we're well-educated in it. We can communicate with people well, and we're going to show through learning, like doing, no matter what we're doing, but also finding that person in management and helping to support them, and then getting the team together. So it's not us talking to them, it's us talking with them, because I think that's already, again, we're shutting, even if you are trying to implement something awesome and positive in your shelter, I think very often people are talking to them and not with them. And then people are not, again, they love the ideas, but then they're shut down because of the way it's presented, unfortunately. So I do think that that is a wonderful way to start. And then, like you said, kind of being like, oh, what do we want the goals? Like, what do we want our standard of care to look like? We understand it's not going to look like this tomorrow. And like you mentioned, behavior always comes up. Yeah. So then it's not you saying it. And I love that so much. Like, I wouldn't have thought of that approach in a shelter setting. And that's genius. And then again, everyone's involved, and it's not just Tabitha or the person that loves behavior saying this. And then you could start with small baby steps, which seem hard at the time. But guys, as Amanda and I know, it might be, hey, can we have a speaker come in and talk to us about body language? Or can we start offering our cats boxes and doing a few other things in the environment, 5 or 6 things that are very practical and easy this month to make the environment less stressful? And then you start to get buy-in because people start to be like, oh, this is actually, that cat is approaching the front of the cage a lot more often. Or that dog, oh, we don't open the gate or the door, the kennel, until the dog sits for just 1 second because it's too challenging. We're going to work up to time duration. And whoa, that makes, this is pretty easy. And this makes a really big difference. And then obviously, then you can start to work on these larger behavior programs that Amanda's offering. But by the time you get there, you have buy-in from the ED and management. And unfortunately, that needs to be a part of it, or it is, we all know, very challenging to get some of these programs started. So I think that is awesome advice. And as far as some of the challenges, because again, this looks different for everybody, because humans and animals are individuals, but some of the challenges that you've experienced, because I know you've been with San Diego Humane for quite a while. And prior to that, you've worked in a lot of similar environments where you were implementing positive change. What were some of the challenges, which we talked a little bit about, that you faced? And in your experience, how did you overcome those challenges?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, where do I start?
I know. I knew you were going to say that. Y'all, challenges. Life is challenging sometimes. That makes the wins better.
You know, and I'll just share it too. Like, there were definitely points, you know, throughout my career, that it was very overwhelming, you know, to try to make changes. I've learned a ton and grown a lot, in not only, you know, my leadership skills, but also being able to bring people to the table so we can talk about how do we make things better for the animals, because ultimately, you know, that's the one. Well, that is a thing, not the one, but right, there's usually more. But I think the most important thing that we all have in common is that we want to make things better for animals, right? Some of the challenges that I have experienced are a lot of times leading or dealing with, you know, sometimes buy-in, you know, or folks who have a different philosophy, you know, and really that doesn't match up with being, you know, low stress or fear-free. And so kind of rushing through interactions, you know, or sometimes even training philosophies, you know. And I think a really important strategy for bringing them along is modeling the way. I think that's so, so very important. And I had to learn that quick in my career, was that I need to somehow show the impact of some of these like smaller changes, right? Or some of the bigger things, philosophy, we won't go down that rabbit hole, but like it, you know, using different types of training tools and things like that, that might be exacerbating, you know, stress and fear in the shelter. But yeah, I mean, a lot of time it had to, you know, do with just kind of misalignment of kind of what our values were, you know, and that's, that being able to bring people to the table and modeling the way and showing them how small changes could impact that animal's experience, I think was the thing that really impacted them the most, to start then having a conversation, you know, about, well, what else can we do? And that happened on multiple levels of, you know, with other coworkers, with folks who maybe reported to me at one time, volunteers, even management. But again, you know, one of the things that I think is really impactful. Show them by doing.
No, 100. I am a huge, because again, I may have not been the best communicator 10 years ago. And I've learned, again, trial and error learning, how to effectively communicate and teach things that you are passionate about. Because that's a whole nother thing. Like you said, this person wants the same for animals as I do. They just may have a different learning history or interpretation of what I'm saying. And me just saying, like, don't you love animals is not necessarily going to help. And in many cases, it's going to cause more tension. So I think I love the idea of approaching it, not even saying, hey, I would love to do this. This is what this looks like, which is also great, but breaking it down more and saying, hey, guys, because I do think picking, no matter what nonprofit, whether you're doing animal rescue or as a business owner, I've learned a lot about some of these things. And what are your mission statements? What are your values? Because those are things that as a staff, you can easily talk about, and they're probably really similar. So you're already getting like, hey, we're all, this isn't us against them. We all want what's best for animals. And although all of us may not love people, which is again, a whole nother podcast, we all want people to love their animals and for animals and people to have a strong human animal bond and for people to understand the importance of that. So we're already starting in a place like, hey, yeah, what are our values? And then based on that, you can kind of create some of these more, hey, this is our mission, this is our value. And then when you're creating behavior programs or anything, whether it may be handling protocols or any other SOPs, you have that baseline to go back to and then kind of move forward. So I definitely agree. I think that's a great way, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges, let's be honest, like people who just don't understand or don't feel, hey, they'll be fine if I hold them down, or they'll be fine, that F word, guys, they'll be fine, F word,
they're fine.
But then through doing, like, no matter whether I'm at a vaccine clinic in GP or with a client training, I show, because I'm always doing the least stressful approach, I'm explaining everything I'm doing and the whys, I may even start describing the animal's body language. So the person, even though they may feel they understand body language, I'm just explaining what I'm doing so they can understand. So even if they don't necessarily agree with it, by me describing, oh, this dog was an FAS5 and saying what that looks like. And I changed my approach. I did this. And now he's expressing blah, blah, blah body language. This isn't about Tabitha or Amanda said this. This is, I'm showing you, mm-hmm. the dog or the cat or the pig is showing you. I'm not making this up. And then, like you said, people start to notice Tabitha can walk that dog loose leash and he sits for 5 seconds before she opens the kennel when he just jumps and lunges a lot and then gets really aroused when, again, like when he's working with me or with cats. Every time I go in to clean that cat's cage, they lunge at me or they hide. But when Amanda goes, that's interesting. The cat's rubbing up against her with relaxed body language. So I do think that those are some great, great places to start. And again, me and Amanda understand how overwhelming and challenging some of these things can be. You are not alone. We love you. And please keep trying to implement positive change and just be the person you want to be in the world. After the elections, I can say that in Ohio. It's a whole nother thing, but that's my mantra for the last few days. I'm just going to be the person I want the rest of the world to be.
Well, and I mean, I'd love to jump off of that is like, you know, the example of like, you know, so you're doing it, you want to be the person that you want to be, right. But you want others to be, right? And they start to observe that, you know, but the example that you used of you narrating and, you know, and sharing, this is why I did that, you're involving them in the conversation too, which helps with that relationship building. It helps with building trust with, you know, with that person. And also, you know, it gives opportunity to kind of sit back about the interaction and be like, huh, well, maybe I should go to like Tabitha and ask her some questions about what I would do if I'm experiencing that in a different scenario, you know, and that opens up room for, you know, if they come to you and ask you a question, say, okay, let's go do this together. you know, and go do it, you know, jointly with them. And again, it just, it kind of snowballs after that, you know, starting to have this open dialogue with, you know, someone who, again, you know, their learning history, they just, whatever their values are, whatever their beliefs are, just may not have been exposed to that or known anything different.
I love that. And kind of just, I know this is a hard question to answer quickly. So we talked about a few ways to get staff and management on board, which I think is a big part. And as you can see, me and Amanda keep continue talking about meeting people where they're at, not shaming or judging. A lot of these things, they sound pretty, but they're real. And showing through doing and always doing your, like, it's a very real thing, being open to asking questions and not, and being open to those questions and actually actively listening to that person. All of that is a very real thing. And both of us have had quite a lot of success implementing positive change on a small, but also a very large level with that. But let's say a shelter has that buy-in, which is beautiful, and they are so excited. I love you guys. I know how it is. And they just want to start everything because they're all so stoked. I know I have a few things, but what are a few things where if they wanted to address the emotional well-being, one or three things, like let's say they were going to start one program, because realistically, it takes time. Even if you do have all the resources possible, you still need and all the support, which is unlikely in most cases, but it still takes time. What type of program or behavior service would you recommend that shelter start with?
Okay, well, so let's start with the animals that are in care for that shelter. I think one of the things that goes a really long way is looking at your enrichment and what opportunities for enrichment those animals have before starting any sort of advanced training or even, you know, behavior modification programs. Get enrichments and opportunities for a variety of different enrichment and an avenue to be able to collect information on whether or not that animal is enjoying it, interacting with it. It's something that is positive for them. I think that's really, really important, that just kind of data collection aspect of it to meet the individual needs. Yeah. So starting with, you know, with enrichment, it could be as simple as, you know, starting to feed your animals in puzzle feeders, right? So instead of, bowls, you could get brown bags donated to you from the public, like those, you know, the brown lunch bags that we used to carry to school, and putting the food in there and letting them shred that up and enjoy their food that way. You can use, if you have the ability to, you know, get Kongs and things like that. I know that they are expensive. We've done those things. I've recently saw a shelter that used rice paper for dogs who can't, the veterinary staff are concerned about ingesting like paper bags and things like that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, using rice paper to kind of ball up food in. So I love that idea. And it's relatively, you know, inexpensive. So that's a simple food, you know, enrichment, auditory enrichment, offering, maybe having some sort of speaker or device that plays classical music, or even getting different scents, lavender, chamomile, peppermint, rosemary, and rotating them. But doing something like that is when you look at like implementation, it doesn't necessarily take a lot of effort, you know, to do those things. And you can even have those things being done by volunteers and not necessarily your staff, which have a million things to do during the day. So internal work, I always say, you know, focus on, you know, enrichment and trying to really get a solid enrichment program going, one that is incorporated into just their daily care before starting to go even bigger and doing training and behavior modification. For internal programs or for external programs, sorry. So working with the community, right? There are a variety of different programs out there. I mentioned that we offer a behavior helpline. It is time intensive. We have a team that is dedicated to answering those calls and those emails and making sure that we're getting to people as quickly as possible. Because sometimes those conversations are, you know, people on the verge of, you know, they're thinking about relinquishment, and we want to try to prevent that. Right. So, usually behavior helplines are not, something that, you know, I recommend to just get started right away, unless you have, you know, volunteers or trainers in the community that they're going to help you, you know, manage those. But it could be as simple as, writing up a few, articles about behavior, or honestly, if you just go to our website, we have a full library of articles and resources and a YouTube channel full of webinars that we've recorded. Put those on your website, and start to make a catalog of resources that you can send out to people when they're calling, for help. And that could be one of the easiest things to do to start with, you know, reaching out to the community and having resources for them.
No, I think that that's a wonderful thing, because enrichment, we're meeting those basic needs to start and getting, and as you said, that's a fairly easy thing that provides a lot of reinforcement for the humans, because there's a lot of wins and it's essentially free. There's tons of enrichment that you can make out of free items or very affordably donated items. So I definitely agree with that. And then I love the resources too, because of course we may work up to doing those larger programs, but even for me as a behavior consultant, I work with a lot of clients, but also vet and shelters. And I have created a lot of content and resources, because I've realized that some people, first off, I can't see everybody all the time. I've come to terms with this. You can't either, you amazing people out there. It's a hard thing, but it's just not realistic, and we are going to burn out and it won't be helpful for anybody. But like my virtual assistant will see someone reach out to me about something and she's like, oh, Tabitha has a handout and a 5-minute video on this. I'm just going to, and that person, it's super serious to that person. They were thinking about relinquishing or maybe even euthanizing their animal. And it's not always that simple, but in some cases it is. In some cases, it's sharing a handout with them instead of them Googling, which we all know how dangerous that can be, or them listening to their well-meaning friends. Again, very dangerous. So just being like, I listen to you, I hear you, here's a resource. And although it may not resolve the issue, it at least tells them, hey, this issue is fairly mild and you can resolve it. And here's a few tips on how.
Well, it also opens, it opens that conversation though with them, you know, as well. And now you are a resource for others in the community, because they may go back to a friend who's dealing with an issue and say, hey, you know what, I reached out to, you know, Tabitha and at, you know, this Humane Society, and they actually sent a really helpful resource, you know, maybe reach out to them, you know, and that's, and so you'll start to see that others in the community will start to, you know, come to you as a resource as well.
And you're not only known for, hey, I don't want my animal anymore.
Exactly.
Which unfortunately, that's a really good point, because I do think community is huge, and many people, again, there's minimal resources. There's cultural fog, as Susan Freeman says. There's a lot of, if you're Googling and don't know, it's rough out there. So by just having these resources and as a shelter that people care about, going to your website and seeing the culture and the humane approaches to training, you're already kind of creating a culture where, like you mentioned, hey, I have a problem. Maybe I can ask them what vet to go to. Or it, again, you're not just being told, I want to relinquish my animal, which that's hard, guys. If that's our only interactions with the public. And I think, unfortunately, for many shelters, it is. So that's another, oh my gosh, all these good points that Amanda is bringing up, you guys. And I know we're going on and on, but what are, to kind of end it, since everyone's going to want to learn more, because all of you are amazing, what are a few of your, you already mentioned San Diego Humane has quite a few resources and they do webinars. I've done a few for them. They have offer a lot of great resources, not for only shelter professionals, but also the general public that you got, because let's not reinvent the wheel. If someone's making a good one, I do that all the time. I share my colleague stuff all the time. But what are a few other of your favorite resources for shelters to learn more about behavior, body language, enrichment, all that lovely stuff?
So, well, I do love Fear-Free Shelter Program. I think that is a really good basic foundational program for your staff, your volunteers, especially there's Happy Homes, Fear-Free Happy
Homes.
Yeah,
they have right? a lot of great stuff.
You got it. they also have a lot of really great stuff. The Shelter Playgroup Alliance is really great for shelter behavior professionals, and especially if you're interested in implementing enrichment or even a playgroup play pairs program. They have some great free education too for those folks who are working in shelters. Maddie's University is another really great resource. The Center for Shelter Dogs, which is a program that is a part of the Cumming School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts. And then there's also a couple books that are pretty recent that I started. They're kind of textbooky. So this is for shelter professionals, but there is a new book on animal behavior in the shelter that was created or written by some folks at the ASPCA, which does have and some other experts in the field, and has some good references and resources and some good information. And then also Mental Health and Well-being in Animals by Franklin McMillan.
Oh, I love him. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
I haven't read that book, but I love him, so I'll have to check that out.
Again, this is textbooky, but it's a really good reference, you know. And so if you're looking for two references to, you know, other papers, or you're curious if, you know, there has been any studies on any of the things that you could want to implement to help with well-being in animals, it's a really good resource. So those are I'm sure I'm forgetting some. Oh, no. I know I
That's
am.
That's a lot. So. And I will share a few resources too, and everything will be in the show notes. So if you're jamming out or listening in your car, which is where I listen to podcasts, or while I'm cleaning my house, you can just check the show notes and everything will be there. But again, I also know behavior resources can be limited and difficult to find as a veterinary professional. That was hard for me. So I understand it's difficult for shelter professionals. So thankfully I had a lot of amazing colleagues that like pointed me in awesome directions. And now I'm all about sharing resources that we've had experience with, that we've seen have made a difference, and that you can use to create behavior programs. But also, as Amanda said, as a reference, because I still reference books. There's certain books that I reference all the time as I'm creating behavior plans or whatever it may, or even writing a lecture. I'm like, is there a study on that? Or what is their approach to this? Not that you should listen 100% to anyone ever. You should always critically think and take things in, but that's a whole nother podcast too. But yeah, we will definitely share that. So thank you so much, Amanda, for sharing those. And how I like to end the podcast, I will definitely have you back on, because I feel like we can go in about a lot of things. And Amanda has a lot of amazing experience, and she's very skilled at communicating things in a way that is easier to understand, because some of these things can be really challenging. What is something that currently makes you happy? This could be your amazing behavior programs, or I had a drink with friends right before this. One drink, guys. I'm not podcasting drunk. But I haven't seen them in a while.
5 p.m. there.
Yeah, I haven't seen them in a while. And that's something that makes me happy right now. But what is something that makes you happy?
So we're, tis the season. We're getting into the holidays. Season.
I love the holidays.
So holiday baking.
Oh, I forgot. She's not local, but she bakes really good stuff.
I am a baker. I love baking. I love baking for people. This is my caregiving part. It feeds my caregiving personality. They're on Netflix right now. There's The Great British Bake Off. Are you?
I don't want to. How far along are you?
I'm caught up. So
okay.
I'm not going to spoil.
Yeah,
anything.
There's four bakers left. That's the last episode I saw.
Yes,
and three of those bakers are amazing, and I love them, and I want them all to win. But
yes, they all are amazing.
They're such a great group this year. Like, they're all so amazing. Anyways, I love that show. Yes,
I love that show. I aspire to be on it. I'm not from the UK, so it's going to be challenging for me to ever find a way to get onto the show. But yes, Holiday Baking and the Great British Bake Off, they currently make me really, really happy. So.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for everything you do. Give a huge shout out and a hug if they appreciate hugs to your whole amazing staff. I know some of them, but I'm sure all of them are amazing. And I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much, Tabitha. And I just want to make sure that, like, if there's anyone out there that needs any help with any of their programs at the shelters, please do not hesitate to reach out to me. I'm more than happy to help you troubleshoot with any of your challenges with programs or provide resources.
I love that so much. I will be sharing her information. She said it, guys.
Yes. Yeah, do it.
Teamwork. We're all in this together and we all want each other to do well, and we need that support. So I will definitely be sharing Amanda's information, and I really appreciate that.
Thanks, Tabitha.
What a wonderful conversation with Amanda. I will be definitely having her back on. So let us know what specific challenges you have had to overcome and how, or what challenges you have and would love to hear more insight and wisdom from Amanda and I. Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and email talesfromanrvt@gmail.com. And thank you for listening.